From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the show today. If ever you have a question you'd like to get on this program, feel free to email that to news@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we've gotten into the summer part of your calendar now, and I'm curious to start out. Does your summer look different in terms of what you do in the job than what you do during the academic year? Obviously, you're done with your classes teaching now, so that's one difference. But is there any other difference in how you go about your work for the next 3 months or so?
Yeah, it's I'm not sure every summer will be the same. Last summer, I spent a lot of time preparing the course, for instance. We talked about that. No, it is a time to catch up, probably put a little more time into the development, which is to say fundraising end of the job. And in the summers, at least the first two I've had here, I've definitely put a few days into what I would call continuing education. There are no shortage of these events one gets invited to you know, speak, but you can also listen. So places like, the Aspen Institute, which I might not make time for during the school year. I might go spend 2 or 3 days and listen to some people wiser than I about a whole variety of topics. And I hope to do one or two of those sometime between now and August.
Speaking of places that you go and have the conversations, you made an interesting comment in Washington, D.C. not long ago that I hadn't heard before, and I wanted to engage you a little bit about it and make sure I understood it fully. You proposed the idea of having sort of benefactors for individual students to try to keep student costs and student loans down. Can you explain to me a little bit about your idea there?
It's not my idea. It's been around a good while, but it sure has attracted a lot of attention, maybe because of the serious problems in student indebtedness now. I just, first of all, I wasn't making a big point of it. I was testifying about ways in which the federal government could lift its clammy hand off of higher ed and enable both lower administrative costs and more innovation. And I tossed it in as an example of an idea which today is inhibited by interpretations of the tax code. And it sure has attracted an awful lot of attention, although it's not new. And the only suggestion is that perhaps as an alternative or an augmentation of what we now have, I'm convinced that a number of people as investors, but your word benefactors would apply in many cases, would like to help young people achieve their college education and would front the money for some specified percentage of a specified number of years of earnings. And this shifts the risk, by the way, to the lender. If the student doesn't work or career doesn't work out, the lender doesn't get their money back or doesn't earn anything meaningful on it. But, of course, we know from experience and the Gallup-Purdue Index and all sorts of directions that Purdue graduates do very, very well, and that this would be a very secure loan for somebody, and it might be the most affordable option, easily manageable option for the student, him or herself. So, since floating the idea, I've heard from at least three young startup organizations who are trying to put together funds to do exactly this. I don't know how it would work, but it would be an interesting option to have. I think it would work well in our case. I can imagine, as opposed to one-to-one loans, a bundle of Purdue students that investors might diversify their risk, so to speak, by lending to a large group. And it might run the gamut from chemical engineers who we know are highly likely to make really good salaries, even out of school, all the way down to some of our other disciplines where—
You could even do it geographically, like all of the graduates of Noblesville High School who go to Purdue in a class.
Of course. Yeah, the market would if free to do so, I think there's a market and it would step in. It's not meant to be a replacement for what we have, but it could be, an augmentation to it. And I honestly believe, by the way, that a number of the investors would be happy to see their return go back into a loan fund and help the next student, converting it into more of a charitable endeavor. We already see that where we talk to people about organizing venture funds to invest in Purdue startups or young innovation companies here. Many of those folks would be happy to see the money evergreen back into the funds.
Yeah, obviously the devil would be in the details. I think of this as the sort of Shark Tank way of trying to fund higher education. And you watch a show like that on television to give people a sense of how this might work. And in many cases, you have to be careful that you're not giving away too much of yourself, your company in this case. The student becomes the company that has the earning potential.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, there'd probably be some bidding process. If you're lending to a petroleum engineer, that person might say, well, I'm only going to be willing to take that loan for a very small percentage of what I think will be significant earnings. But the market would find its level. And once again, it shifts the risk to the to the lender, the investor. If the student doesn't work or doesn't pan out, no skin off his nose, but the investor would lose. And that's the reverse, of course. In the government, you never get away from it. You can't even get out of it in bankruptcy.
While we're on the subject of student costs, let's talk a little bit about, and we should mention, we're taping this program before the school's Board of Trustees meet, and it'll air after that. But one of the big things on their agenda is talk about the tuition and fee increases or freezes. And it looks like you're proposing a fourth consecutive year of the tuition freeze. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And how did you come to the decision? When we talked about this a year ago, you said, we're not quite sure how long it could last. We take it on a year-by-year basis. How did you determine that year four would be fiscally possible?
We did what you do with any budget. We carefully analyzed and watched what our revenues would be. And that has to do, among other things, with how many students are coming to Purdue. We had a record number of applications. We have a record number of, at least in any recent year, deposits, and it looks like we'll have a significantly larger freshman class. So that's one factor. We had to see what the state government would do. I should say that was not a positive factor. We will wind up paradoxically, I think, with slightly fewer dollars next year, not because they don't appreciate Purdue, but because the funding formula that's in place looks backwards. And so we did a little better than it looked we might, but not
still
as well.
Down about 1% or so,
yeah,
from the state government.
It is, and that's a topic for a different day, I think. But you were asking how you put these things together. You have to look at your main sources of income. And of course, you look at the spending side, which we've been working on in ways large and small. And then, but we approached it with two goals in mind. One is student affordability, and the other is continued investment in excellence. And so this same budget proposal includes what we are pretty sure will be the biggest increase for salaries of faculty and staff in our peer group at 3.5%.
And explain a little bit about how you plan to allocate that money.
Right. Well, there is we're going to definitely provide 3.5% more dollars in wages and salaries next year. There are a couple of features that I think are noteworthy with that. One is we're going to level up the entry-level pay, the bottom pay for any job on Purdue to at least $10 an hour for any full-time job. And that'll carry in anybody who's already here and under that number today. Then, secondly, we are going to make the last half percent of 3.5 conditional on each unit. And here we're talking about the colleges and the major large administrative units, so 15 to 20 in total, helping out on three basic goals: reduction of high-paid administrative positions, a better utilization of our capital plant, our space, whether it's classroom or facilities, whatever it might be, and better differentiation of the best performance from the worst. So this last half percent will be completely voluntary. No unit has to help. If any unit doesn't, their half percent will go in the pool, and, so, and the other units who do participate will get 3.6 or 3.7 or however the math works. But we hope every unit will jump in, and it'll be completely flexible. There'll be any number of ways, as long as they're real, as long as they're not a shell game or a temporary or in some way.
Don't fudge the numbers, basically.
That's right. As long as it really makes Purdue more efficient for the long term, bring on all the ideas that are out there. That's the way we see it working, and I'm, to tell you the truth, I'm pleased about the outlines of this budget, and I hope the campus will be.
You mentioned the differentiation between the pay given to the quote-unquote top performers and the people who are perhaps not pulling their weight. And this is always something that's tough to assign and is one of the tougher jobs of any boss to determine who is actually the top performer. And have you given any instructions to the individual unit heads to try to ferret out who those people are, given them metrics that they might want to look at to determine who really are deserving of the top raise bracket?
No, that's the job of leadership. And it will differ from place to place. Because it's hard, you're quite right, because it's not easy, there's a tendency to spread the dollars more or less evenly. And we've looked, and in almost all units, there'll be a few who have been rewarded for apparently really good performance. And occasionally you'll see a few who didn't get a raise or got a very small one. But generally the pattern is the peanut butter gets spread pretty evenly. And so we just want to encourage greater differentiation. It's not fair that the best performers get treated more or less the same as those who really aren't doing their part. And it's not right for those who are not doing their part to just be able to drift along. It's really not even in their interest. Someone needs to be honest with them and explain to them it's not you're not doing what you can, and hopefully work on a plan for improvement. But so we'll just be asking each unit to show us more of a commitment to rewarding the best performers, whether they are faculty, clerical staff, admin staff, professional sport, wherever they are, it's the job of leadership to recruit good people, to identify the best, and to reward them when they perform. And conversely, it's the job, if there are folks in a large organization, there'll always be some who are not meeting standards, to deal with it somehow.
You mentioned the idea of trying to find efficiencies, especially where administration is concerned. Does that mean that there is some sort of an emphasis put on losing jobs to attrition if somebody decides to leave the university for some reason, or you and I were chatting before the show and you mentioned the idea of taking somebody who is an administrator and moving them back to being a full-time faculty member or something? But in order to find an efficiency there, you would seem to have to reduce a salary or reduce a benefit in some way. How do you see all of that playing out in terms of that sort of efficiency?
Well, we have a fairly significant number of people, and they're doing important jobs in the main, but we've got an awful lot of people who are faculty who right now are working entirely or largely on administrative jobs. They're the associate dean of this or the vice provost for that, and they are given a, what's called an administrative supplement on top of their faculty pay. And the one option in this flexible system, one option for people with such folks on staff is to look to see whether those jobs are absolutely necessary. And you get a twofer, by the way, in these cases, if somebody is freed up from these administrative roles and you get a full-time faculty member back, which is something we're out to do. You know, we are growing the number of faculty at Purdue at a fairly steady rate right now. As the number of administrative staff has come down, not dramatically, but it has come down. But the ratio of faculty to administrators is getting significantly better. So anything we can do that puts more people in the classroom, more people back in the laboratory and working on the core assignments of our land-grant school is a positive thing. So it's really important to remember that this 3.5% increase for salaries, again, probably the biggest in our peer group, at least that we've found to date, is only part of the investment we're making. The so-called big moves investments are multi-million dollars each, and those are proceeding along. They include, of course, in engineering, computer science, and College of Technology, and so forth, significant increases in faculty. It's really important for people to see that when we talk about value, as I often do, quality over cost, these are complementary goals of Purdue University. We want more quality. We want to invest in excellence, and we are. And we want to control the cost to students. And that's how you produce, as we like to say, the highest value in proven value in higher education.
You mentioned also the possibility of changing the way the class schedule works. And I know that I've talked to a number of professors who say they right now try to take care to have their classes on certain days or at certain times. And I know there's been a lot of specificity in these requests over a number of years from higher education faculty. Does this mean that there's going to be less ability to request when you teach your class and more focus on teaching on Mondays and Fridays, which at least since I was a student 10 and 15 years ago, and maybe even at the time when you were a student, was something that was just, it was more common to have classes in the middle of the week than on the ends?
Well, you can speak for yourself about that. I remember Saturday classes, you know. No, again, this is all purely voluntary. But surely one way that a college, for instance, can check the box about helping with use of facilities would be to add some Monday and Friday classes. When you look, and we have, there's a big bell curve, low on Monday, higher on Tuesday, really high on Wednesday and Thursday, and down on Friday, in terms of how we use the space. And so people who say, I'm having trouble finding a classroom, if they're insisting on Wednesday or Thursday, I can see why. So there's one option. But again, the system will be set up so to recognize that every situation is somehow different and to make total room for alternative ways to help us approach this common goal.
You're listening to Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. If you've got questions for this show, you can always email those to news@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions @WBAAnews on Twitter. You have also asked the trustees to adopt the University of Chicago's principles of free expression. Why was that important to you? Why was this something you wanted to address with them?
Well, it's not necessarily my idea. The trustees have been watching and reading, and we all have, and seeing the really sad and in some cases disgraceful trespasses of free speech principles on college campuses. As recently as a few days ago in the local newspaper, a national column appeared cataloging the latest, almost surrealistic to me. Abuses of free speech, distortions of the idea. And on college campuses where, if anywhere, free speech should be revered. So I think some of the trustees noticed this really remarkable explication at the University of Chicago just a few months ago. And as they read it, we all read it, it seems it's such an effective enunciation of where we thought the university should be. They didn't think it could be improved on, and so maybe just simply embrace it, absent the Chicago-specific language. In the interim, since the board first began reading and thinking about it, that one other university has done this, and it may spread more widely, but it's clearly a response to these very disquieting events in which speakers are shouted down, harassed, disinvited, and professors who are trying simply to get a good debate going so that students can consider pros and cons and think critically are punished for doing what really is a central job of higher education. And we don't want Purdue to be a part of that. In fact, we want Purdue to be seen as one of the most staunchest defenders of academic freedom and the freedom of speech for everybody in the campus community.
I wanted to read for our listeners a small part of that statement and then ask you a question or two. It says, because the university is committed to free and open inquiry in all matters, it guarantees all members of the university community the broadest possible latitude to speak, write, listen, challenge, and learn. Except insofar as limitations on that freedom are necessary to the functioning of the university fully respects and supports the freedom of all students, faculty, and staff to, quote, to discuss any problem that presents itself, end quote, free of interference. I wanted to ask you how this jibes with something we talked about on a previous program, which is Purdue's longstanding policy of not getting into some outside issues, especially social issues like the Religious Freedom Bill that you and I talked about before. Does this run into that in some ways?
No, it's absolutely consistent with it. By the way, the University of Chicago has a separate set of principles issued two, 3 decades ago called the Kelvin Principles that speak to the separate question of whether the university institutionally should wade into these things. And so the university that authored both these statements has made it, I think, crystal clear that the university's role is to protect and encourage the most vigorous debate possible, which we do and intend to do here at Purdue University. It is not the university's role, say the Kelvin Principles, and, you know, frankly, the vast majority of American universities abide by these, to step in institutionally taking positions on questions like that.
Does that mean the president can take a position that the university itself might not take? Because you're allowed free speech under this policy as a staff member of the university.
Sure. But, you know, I think you have to be extraordinarily careful about doing that so that you're that anything you do say is not imputed to the institution itself. But, you know, the central point here is to make certain, and we're already, I think, have a great record at Purdue about this. I mean, just look at the people who've been through this campus in the last year. There's a huge spread. And that's the way it ought to be. And however, we've identified, the board asked us to look, there are two or three, they're fairly minor, policies that could be even more liberal than they are. And so we'll act on those so that we live up to the words of those principles, assuming the trustees do proceed.
Moving on to a couple other things in just our last few minutes, we're in the midst of the search, the beginning stages of the search for the chancellor of the new Purdue Northwest campus. What kinds of characteristics, qualities do you want that person to have?
It's a really important question because this would always be an important search, of course, but there's an even greater, I think, urgency and a little difference on this one because a large part of the merger or consolidation of work will still be there when the new permanent chancellor is named. Now, the two chancellors have been working great. They've made a lot of progress. A whole lot of decisions have been made, and they're going to lead to significant savings, which can go back into academic purposes. But the new person will have a lot of work yet to do to build relationships and on both campuses to bring people together to get more and more value out of the having one administration, not two, and to look for chances to synergize the faculty and the academic programs that are on those two campuses. And there have been a lot of thought going into this already. When you're only 35 miles apart, there may be things you can teach really well on one campus and not duplicate on the other. It'll take, I think, an unusually skillful person. One of the incumbents up there is eligible and has a head start, you could say, and we're glad he's going to make himself available. But a national search seemed in order for what is going to be an exciting but challenging assignment.
When you look for somebody to come into Northwest Indiana, do you look for somebody who has some geographical knowledge of that region? Is that important in some way, or is it more organizational leadership that you're looking for?
Good question. The search committee will have to decide this. I believe local knowledge would be very, very helpful, but it's not always decisive. We got a really good chancellor out at Fort Wayne who came from very, very far away a couple, 3 years ago. So it's probably, I'm guessing now, that the committee will value it where it sees local knowledge, but it won't be determinative. And if you got a great leader, possibly a great scholar, you know, something who had the right skill set, I'm sure they have a chance.
We sort of glossed over it earlier, but I wanted to spend just a couple of quick minutes on it. We're now through the first legislative session where you actively lobbied on Purdue's behalf, and you mentioned a little bit ago that Purdue was down about 1% in terms of its appropriation from the state. How overall did you think the university fared in this legislative session? How would you characterize it in 90 seconds?
Since we started with terrible field position, I feel okay about where we wound up. The formula said we were going to lose $11 million here at West Lafayette, and we got back to within a couple million. In addition, we're the only university that did receive a new line item, $3 million one-time support for the Purdue Polytechnic Institute. At least we anticipate that'll be its name following this coming board meeting. Great excitement about that, how it might fit very well into the Indiana economy. So compared to where we started, we did very, very well. But a question I think for the next legislature is, do we have this starting point really right when a university as central to Indiana's future, as valuable to Indiana's present as Purdue is, when the black box quits worrying, you know, starts out in the hole compared to other places?
All right. Well, that, unfortunately, is the time we have, but fortunately, I have plenty more questions I can address with you on future shows, so we'll look forward to doing it again next month.
Well, there's a chance I'll be back.
And if ever you, our listeners, have questions for Purdue President Mitch Daniels, you can send those to news@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can find archived versions of this program at wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.